Bet the board.
What do you mean you don't bet?
I mean, I don't bet. You know, I don't care. I don't. I never have, and I never will.
Yeah, right.
I'll bet you $20 I can get you gambling before the end of the day.
You owe me $15,000, pal.
Pay him. Pay that man his money.
It's the Bet the Board podcast.
God likes me. He really, really likes me.
In the end, I wound up right back where I started. I could still pick winners, and I could still make money for all kinds of people back home. And why mess up a good thing?
Here's Payne Insider and Todd Furman.
Welcome into the Bet the Board podcast. College football week two, the topic at hand. And oh, what a show we have planned for you that I'm sure will come with a couple of tangents and maybe an epic rant from a man who really needs no introduction. I am, of course, Todd Furman, your fearless leader, joined as always by the one, the only, Payne Insider.
You're still going with the fearless leader thing?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's, you know, maybe it's an oxymoron. Nobody really believes it. I'm not quite sure. I'll have to try and figure it out. So if anybody out there is smart, creative, I know people love our opening intro. They're welcome to write my script, and I'm happy to read off a piece of paper. So we'll throw that out there to all those aspiring journalism students.
Fearless. There we go. That's a nice descriptive for you. I don't think it's accurate, but, you know.
To make some of the bets we do, you often have to be fearless, and that may be a little foreshadowing for the direction we'll choose to go later on in this fine program. But Payne, you know, before we get into talking about the NFL contest, despite it being a college football podcast, before we preview the five biggest games of the weekend, do you have anything you want to get off your chest after what you saw last weekend in Tallahassee? I know a lot of our listeners have been waiting with bated breath for this particular rant.
I don't know why that is. I'm pretty calm. I'm pretty cool. I'm pretty collected. I don't really get too nuts these days at my old age. Here's the rule in a life, right? Here's a painism. Here's a life lesson for you. Underpromise and overdeliver. And that's really the problem with Willie Taggart. Came in here, thought he was just going to turn this thing back around or start winning championships again. And the fans got a false hope. Because if you look at Louisville, right? What did they do the other night? They lost by 18. Everyone's like, man, love what Louisville's doing. They're on the right track. It's because the coach came out. Satterfield was like, hey, this is going to be a long rebuilding process. But that's not what Willie Taggart did, and he's still not doing it. And I hate the excuses because
What's going on there? I mean, just own it, be accountable. And here you are making excuses 3 days later talking about conditioning. Like, come on, give it a rest.
Strength and conditioning coach was not happy. He is highly respected in the field, had multiple offers from schools that are currently better than Florida State, and he declined. So it was a weird approach to take. Listen, I don't care how good a shape you're in. I don't care where you practice every day. If you're on the field for 108 plays, you're going to gas out in that weather, no matter if you practice in it or not. And I think a lot of that was partly because of the defense, right? The way they played. I didn't love Harlan Burnett's system. Initially, it was, hey, we're going to make this freshman beat us. We're going to make him be accurate, pick us apart a little bit. But once he did that, there wasn't enough pressure sent. There wasn't enough heat sent. All the blitzes seemed to work. That's how they got their pressure. So there just wasn't enough three and outs. And that's partly why Florida State's defense was on the field for so much. And I think a lot of people would be like, hey, you know, the offense struggled. That's Taggart in general, right? You go back to his Oregon days, averaged 12.2 points per game in the second half. These offenses, and I know people love them, but it's a college offense. If you can win on the defensive line and you can tackle well and you can be disciplined, these aren't the most difficult offenses to figure out. And Kendall Briles is a genius. Everyone looks at him like this is a great offensive mind, and he'll come out and be like, hey, don't really have a playbook. That's what these college offenses are. If you can win the battle up front, be disciplined, and tackle well, you have a chance to stop them. So after you've seen it numerous times, you have a chance to be successful. And that's kind of what happened in the second half. But if you look at a whole, as a whole, and you said before the game, hey, FSU's offense is going to average 6.9 yards per play, you're taking that because they didn't do that against a Power 5 defense all last season. And to me, at the same time, what's the vibe this morning if FSU wins that game? There's just so much pressure on Florida State in my mind that they had to win it that now everyone thinks it's a big deal. And I get it when you look at the offense, right? Very good in the first half, 55% of their first down plays were successful. In the second half, it dipped to 30%. They couldn't sustain some of these drives, but you're not going to fault them in the first half for scoring on one play or having all these explosive plays. You'd obviously like your offense to do that, but it set up the defense poorly in the second half. But again, it's partly on them. You have two seniors who don't know to fall on a football. One of them's trying to pick it up and take it 96 yards. Just fall on the ball. The other big thing here, and no one's talking about it, and it's driving me nuts. First in 10 at the Boise 33, up 12 points. Cam Akers is a five-star running back. He's supposed to be one of the leaders of your offense. He fumbles and chokes the game away. And so I get the idea that Willie Taggart failed here, but at some point it's got to be on the players. At some point, you know, you're looking at this game, there's 4 minutes to go in the third quarter, you're up 12, you're in the green zone, you score a touchdown there and you go up 19 or 20, the game's freaking over, right? See you, good night, Boise, grab some McDonald's fries on the way home back to Idaho, game's over, forget about it. Cam Akers can't fumble the football there. So it's a different story, it's a different narrative if that one play changes. So for me, Taggart's got to do a better job of assessing what he has and kind of depicting that to the public. But some of these guys have to step up. And I liked what I saw a little bit. I just think the defense needs to be more aggressive this year because they're going to give up some plays.
Going to be very interesting to see how the Seminoles rebound. Of course, big favorites this weekend against Louisiana Monroe. Will not be one of the five featured games that we get to here on the Bet the Board podcast. But Payne, before we get into those games, I want to give everybody a quick little contest update and refresher as we eclipse the 2,000 mark, inching ever so close towards 3,000 entries in the 5K football free roll for the professional ranks.
Yes, over 2,100 entries I saw this morning. So we are on pace to eclipse last year's record number. It's very simple. You go to bettheboardcontest.com. You sign up. It's an NFL contest, free to join. Pick five games a week against the spread. It's a $5,100 prize pool for the season-long aspect of it, but we give out prizes each of the 17 NFL weeks. So if you win the week, you get a prize. It's a Visa gift card. It's some Bet the Board swag, t-shirts, pens in that package. So bettheboardcontest.com. Go there, sign up. It's a great contest. If you can't make it out to Vegas and join those pick five contests, this is your alternative. I know a lot of people can't afford to fly across the country, don't want to deal with a proxy. This is the alternative. Bettheboardcontest.com. Sign up, and you have until Sunday to do so.
Absolutely free as well. So if budget factors into the equation, this one's free. So the price is always right. And you'll have a beautiful trophy to put up in your man cave, your she shed, wherever you choose to display it. I personally prefer over the fireplace. All right, Payne.
The she shed. I like.
You know, we have some female listeners out there. I think probably 1% of our audience is female, maybe under. I'm not quite sure.
Yeah, I think last time we checked, it was like 1.5%. And one of them might live under your roof.
No, she definitely doesn't listen to the podcast. she definitely doesn't. If it was up to her, she'd get to come on and comment on her favorite team. And we're not allowing that kind of behavior. We can't have any homerism. As it pertains to some of our biggest games. But let's kick things off this weekend in Death Valley, where it's the Clemson Tigers playing host to the Texas A&M Aggies. We're looking at Clemson, a 17.5 point favorite. Total in this game, 64-64.5. A revenge scenario from a game that was decided on the final possession last year, a 28-26 victory for Clemson. And Payne, we look at the way these two teams started the season. Clemson, a workmanlike 52-14 win over Georgia Tech. Tigers won by 20-plus points for a school record 11th consecutive game. Only twice last season did they win by fewer points. And as we alluded to, one game was against the Aggies. Meanwhile, Texas A&M, a 41-7 win over Texas State. And it just may have the Aggies brimming with a little confidence and bravado that Jared Hocker comes out and says there will be an upset. If an upset is to happen or even an A&M cover, what kind of things need to unfold in your mind?
Bold statement. Didn't love it. Just be quiet.
One of Jimbo's guys, man. Although that was the best part. That Jimbo gets asked about it, had no knowledge that this comment was made, and basically says, yeah, well, he better show up then.
It's the right thing to say, I would hope. For Jimbo Fisher. For me, this feels like the game A&M circled all offseason, right? If you listened to Kellen Mond all offseason, if you've listened to him so far this week, like this was the game. Seeing Clemson win the entire thing last year and you only lose to him by two, it was a huge motivator, I know, for him. And it's been the motivator for the team all spring and summer. And I actually liked what I saw from the A&M offense in their opening game. And I think a lot of people will be like, oh, you know, Texas State. I can tell you they're no joke defensively. Like, don't be fooled. I know we projected Texas State's defense. They had 10 guys returning on that side of the ball. We thought they'd finish top 50 in defensive efficiency. So to see Mon go out there and put up 6.6 yards per play. And, you know, you see this Aggies O-line that returns five guys that started seven or more. They didn't allow a single negative play. So that was big time. No sacks allowed. No tackles for loss allowed. Four of the 36 runs were stuffed at the line of scrimmage by the Texas State. That was it. So I liked what I saw from the offensive line. The one thing that I noticed that was pretty clear is it tells me Jimbo Fisher has more confidence in Kellen Mond. And I don't think it seems like a big deal on the outside. But if you look, A&M only passed the ball 48% of the time last season. Seeing them pass 51% in this game, right, being up 41-7 in a blowout, they led by double digits for 47 minutes. It tells me we're going to see more Mond throwing this year. And I think that's probably a positive thing. He's improved in that aspect of his game. I don't see a scenario where A&M's intimidated going into Death Valley, right? I think Mond's going to have confidence. You know, he played against Clemson last year in September, right? That was his second game in Jimbo's new system. So, you know, you put up 430 yards, three touchdowns, and a 173 passer rating against a better defense. I think he comes in here bringing with confidence. I really do. What makes me a little nervous here, Todd, is the line. And I know you had the summer number and it was right at the same thing. And I guess I'm probably overreacting to that. But my mind is like, man, why is this line so high? Because I'm kind of fearful of what the market's telling me. And so that's kind of why I'm staying away here a little bit. It says that A&M doesn't have a chance. But I love the X factor. I think Jimbo Fisher's familiarity with Dabo. You know, they played eight times when Jimbo was the head coach at Florida State. They split the series 4-4. In the four losses for FSU, Jimbo was only outscored by an average of 8.8 in those losses. So he's gone into Death Valley, in my opinion, with worse teams than his current A&M squad. And he's faced better Clemson defenses than this one. And he's come out with better results. So it just makes me nervous what the market's saying here.
Well, when we look at this, and of course, Kellen Mond matched up against a relatively inexperienced Clemson defense, I think is going to be fascinating. And you mentioned the fact that he threw for 430 yards last year in a loss at home. We see A&M trying to break in two younger running backs who went for 200 plus last week against Texas State. On the other side of the ball, my major reservations with the Aggies were their ability to stop the run. We know that was the strength of what they did defensively a year ago, a largely new front seven on that side. And when you look at Clemson's debut against Georgia Tech, they ran the ball for 411 yards, averaging 8.4 yards per carry over 49 carries. Travis Etienne ran for his 40th touchdown, ends up joining exclusive company with CJ Spiller, Travis Zachary, and James Davis as the only other Tigers that have 40 touchdowns in their career. Do you trust A&M's defense to get enough stops to slow down this Clemson offense that, let's be honest here, didn't look great, especially in the passing game in the opener?
God, does NTN just so improved. It's wild, like watching some of those runs. I mean, his vision is just so much better. It's wild to see that improve so much. You mentioned this a little bit. Clemson wins in a blowout fashion. You know, they cover the 34.5 or whatever the number it kind of peaked to towards closer to kick. I wasn't impressed. I really wasn't. Like, that first half against Georgia Tech was pretty ugly. Like, it's 28-0 at the break, but the score is a little misleading. You know, you have the two scoring drive touchdowns. It's a grand total of 30 yards. And then the other two Clemson touchdowns, it's the explosive 80-yarder from NTN, and then you have the, you know, the 62-yarder where Higgins just makes this ridiculous play on a 50-50 ball. Clemson wasn't very good early on, only successful on 38% of their first down snaps in the first half. Now, to your point here, the A&M defense, they weren't tested at all against Texas State. I mean, this is an offense. It's the opposite of the other side of the ball for the Texas A&M game in game one. This is an offense that, you know, Texas State just, they were projected to finish bottom five in the entire country in efficiency. So, you know, this could be a little bit of a shock to the Aggie system with Trevor Lawrence and all the talent there. I think the key on this side of the ball is obviously the A&M secondary. And it seems to be what Jimbo's been preaching this week about shutting down the big play. Again, like last week, did a good job, only gave up one explosive to Texas State. And before the final drive, where Texas State goes out there and puts up like 82 yards, A&M only allowed 3.6 yards per pass attempt. So, you know, again, not a great gauge, but that secondary for me was a concern last year. And A&M was 119th in the country in explosive play defense, 96th in adjusted yards per pass. And if you remember on our preview podcast, we talked about this a little bit. It's why Jimbo went out and he recruits five new guys in the secondary during this recruiting class. So if they can make Trevor Lawrence work to score here, I think Jimbo and the Aggies have a shot, right? To me, I still like the front seven. It's the best part of their defense. You mentioned last year they created just a lot of havoc. It was 100 tackles for loss. They slowed their opponents down on the ground. It was 19th in defensive rushing efficiency, top 10 in both line yards and stuff rate. I just think that they're going to do a little bit better job stopping the ground game here. It's just if the secondary can hold up. Honestly, I was hoping that Jimbo, who's kind of shown a tendency to be a little lenient, DeBione Renfro. He was suspended for the first game. There was talks about maybe him coming back. He's a starting corner. I would have liked had Jimbo been a little bit more lenient and lifted that suspension a game early.
Going to be one hell of a game to define two team seasons. We know A&M will have a lot of other measuring stick contests throughout their rigors of the SEC West. This, at least on paper as things stand now, will be the toughest game Clemson will play until maybe an ACC championship and obviously the potential to be in the college football playoff as a 17-point favorite. From the early day appetizer pain to the marquee game on the evening slate, which will pit two proud programs, LSU and Texas, against one another. You're looking at LSU now a 6.5-point favorite for their trip to Austin. Total in this game, 55, bet up a little bit from the opener. Second game between these programs in 50 years, first in the regular season since 1954. And people around Austin and, you know, the Texas program are calling this the biggest home game that the Longhorns have played since Ohio State visited back in 2006. I think when we look at this contest, I want to start with the quarterback play. Sam Ellinger on one side, Joe Burrow on the other. Which of those two pivots do you have more confidence in a game of this magnitude?
I like LSU. You know, I think their offensive situation is trending in the right direction. I was a little stunned how LSU operated, right? It was like all gas, no break for Burrow in the passing game coordinator there that we've been raving about, Joe Brady, in the opener. And so I was stunned with, you know, how much they showed of this new look LSU offense and how much they put on film. They were just letting it fly against Georgia Southern. Didn't hold much back. And we saw some of that explosiveness that we've been looking for. It's 14 plays of 10 or more for LSU's offense. Last season only averaged 8.5 plays per game of 10 or more. So that was a positive. You look at LSU's offense, averaged 6.6 yards per play. That was 1.3 more than their season average last year. And then you talk about just some of these big plays they were creating. All of last year, LSU's offense had 9 plays of 40 or more. They had 3 in the opener. And I get, you know, it's Georgia Southern. But this is, to me, a completely different vibe offensively for LSU. It looks different. There's tempo. There's pace. Burrow's getting lined up quicker. He's getting the plays in from the sideline. Everything just feels different. It looks better. In the first half, when LSU was playing to their game plan and not the scoreboard, right? We always talk about looking at the first half stuff because that's the design of the offense. That's the game plan coming in. You're not adjusting for what's going on at halftime. And, you know, if you're down by 14 or you're up by 20, the first half is basically dictating what you wanted to do. And so if you look at LSU in the first half, between snaps, it was only 16 seconds. That was the average. So they're getting up to the line of scrimmage faster. They're snapping the ball faster. I liked everything about the LSU offense. I want to see now if you can do it on the road against a Power 5 defense. But, you know, I think we've talked about this ad nauseum with the Big 12 podcast. I'm not in love with the Texas defense. And so I think they're going to have some success here, LSU's offense. I didn't like what I saw in game one. And I think, you know, Texas is in store defensively for another drop in efficiency. If you look what Texas did against La Tech, La Tech was forced to punt 2 times the entire damn game. You know, they gave up 5.1 yards per play against a La Tech offense. We projected to finish outside the top 100 in efficiency. And so, again, it was a concern coming into the season. We know Todd Orlando, the defensive coordinator, had to replace 9 guys, virtually the entire front 7. So we had question marks about how Texas is going to get pressure on the quarterback. And so maybe we see a little bit more of that zone blitz that Orlando loves to employ, but registered 1 sack against La Tech. That's scary to me. And if you look at La Tech, this is a team who allowed an 11% sack rate on passing downs a season ago, outside the top 100 in college football. And, you know, you take it one step further. You look at Jamar Smith, the La Tech quarterback, completed 34 of his 51 attempts, 67%. You look at him as a career passer, completed 56% as a sophomore, 57% as a junior. So there is a lot of concern, I think, for the Texas defense. And I'm looking at this, in my mind, if Texas wants to win on this side of the ball, and I get that they're young, but I think you have to use and rely on your talented corners to play press here. You know, buy the D-line some extra time to get to Burrow. And I think at the same time, it's going to choke out that short passing game. Because if you look, as great as Burrow was, as great as the LSU offense was, only 17 of his 27 pass attempts, they traveled 5 yards or less. So, you know, if you can press and kind of hinder that short passing game, I think that's probably the only chance the Longhorns actually have here. Because if you can do that, have you seen, and this is just kind of, I've looked at the numbers, I've watched them play.
Yep.
Really the last like season and a half, LSU hasn't been able to like move guys in the trenches. The ground game hasn't been great. You know, LSU finished 81st in rushing efficiency last year, 85th in adjusted yards per rush. If you look at what they did, you know, against the Georgia Southern defense that we project to finish, you know, barely inside the top 90, only 3.8 yards per rush attempt last week. So I don't know if you can choke out that short pass game from Burrow and Brady if LSU is going to be able to do enough on the ground. That's my big question here.
Well, I think one of the things that has to be a little bit promising for LSU, when you look at their lineage of running backs, the Darius Geises and Leonard Fournettes of the world weren't exactly pass catchers coming out of the backfield. And whether it's right. Overreacting to just one game, which is a very limited sample size, I was extremely intrigued, Payne, by the fact that running backs caught 12 balls last week, which has obviously been a staple of what we've seen from the Saints and Coach Brady, the way he got Alvin Kamara involved for years. So if that's the case, knowing that Texas may have to blitz to try and heat up Burrow, having that confidence level to dump the ball to your running back, whether it's through screens, whether it's a variety of other ways, I think bodes extremely well. But on the other side of the ball, you know, when we look at Texas, Sam Ellinger, hey, first player last year, you know, to have 25 passing touchdowns and 15 rushing touchdowns. We know that Texas's running back depth appears to be depleted. I think that's a little bit of smoke and mirrors beyond Keyonte Ingram. But at the same time, I mean, this wasn't a Texas offense that showed explosive big play potential. They were more a methodical team that had a drive down the field. And what we've seen in the past against LSU defenses, that doesn't work. You have to be able to hit the home run. I don't know if Texas can do that here.
Yeah, spot on. And there's also a game within the game here. Tom Herman and Dave Aranda are very close, know each other's philosophies, know each other's mindsets. They were actually college roommates at Cal Lutheran. So there's a lot of familiarity here. This is a monster test for Texas. And you hit it right on the head. In my mind, the Longhorns offense was one of the most fraudulent units in all of college football last season. 5.4 yards per play. That was outside the top 70 in college football. You mentioned this. Zero big play ability a season ago. 115th in explosiveness. They were forced to run Sam Ellinger because they couldn't get enough production from the running backs. And as a whole, you look, Texas was 98th in rushing efficiency last year. If you exclude the Sugar Bowl, the 13 other games Texas played, the average efficiency rank of the defenses they faced was 67th. So on paper, an Excel sheet, metrically speaking, this is probably the toughest defense Tom Herman and Sam Ellinger have faced together at Texas. So I don't know. I would expect this means probably more designed runs for Ellinger. If you look last season versus ranked opponents, Ellinger ran the ball 40% more than he did against non-ranked opponents. And if you listen to the post-game presser after La Tech, despite 8 rushes, Ellinger claims only one was designed. So, you know, for me, if Texas is going to have success on this side of the ball, it's got to be the down-to-down efficiency, because I don't see them being able to hit the big play. They got to be successful on first downs. To me, they have to be more physical in the trenches. And we've seen LSU, you know, again, very fast defense, likes to play downhill. But they've, relatively speaking, get pushed around a little bit in the trenches at times recently. You look, LSU 34th in adjusted yards per rush last year, 84th in line yards, 49th in stuff rate. So it's got to be about Texas, that O-line imposing their will, Ehlinger probably carrying the ball 15 to 20 times in this game. Because if you don't get that explosiveness, this is the only way you got to do it, right? You got to be able to kind of punch them in the mouth and be more physical up front. It's the only chance Texas's offense has.
One last thing on this game, and I know it's going to get talked about a lot, so we may as well address it here. Tom Herman's track record as an underdog. As a head coach, 13-2-1 against the spread. He's 8-2-1 in that role while an underdog at Texas. So kind of in the same breath, I have to throw that out there, but I also want to talk about the number, Payne, because there was a very wide-ranging difference of opinion as far as where this was going to be with Game of the Year numbers. We saw some shops as recently as about 10 days ago have Texas as a one-point favorite. We saw that some folks didn't agree. They made LSU a four-point favorite. Market opens very similarly, and we've seen money come in on the Tigers driving this closer to seven. Not sure where you want to take it, but just felt those were points that we had to get out there.
They were very good points. Again, sample size, I don't really, unless we find out that Tom Herman's got this secret speech or what he's doing with these roles as an underdog. I don't know if it's relevant. I know people like it. A lot of people will be talking about it all week. For me, it's a really small sample size. So it's not anything like we're taking into huge effect for me. And I hate to say this, we're debating what to do with this game. Obviously, I don't think we're going to have a true position at this point. We have a significantly better number on LSU than the current line is. And as we're talking about it right now at 11 a.m. Eastern time, LSU looks like a buy order just came in and this is now LSU -6.5. So I didn't want to have to try to middle this game, but maybe.
Dynamic changes an awful lot if it gets to a full seven. Let's not kid ourselves.
A lot of people, if you're listening, why I have what appears to be ADD and get distracted is I have like six screens up now at the odd screen. I'm just watching stuff come in and I'm watching stuff on back ends come in. And so, yes, LSU out to 6.5. It's actually like 6.7 right now with juice. For me, I'm not playing anything on this game at the current number, but all signs point to, and this is the market. Now, it may have overreacted, but we've kind of been talking about this a little bit. We're down on Texas relative to the market. Sharp guys pummeled their season win total under 9.5. LSU is a team that we had power rated in the top four. They were one of the most impressive teams last week. It all starts to make sense when you put the puzzle together. But I'm not running now to lay like 6.7.
Perfect storm here. But a game that'll bear watching, no doubt about it. From that game that'll have a national impact, this one I think a little more fascinating from a regional standpoint. And two programs who have big expectations this season on different levels. Primetime under the lights in Chapel Hill, where it's the Miami Hurricanes fresh off of a bye in that season opening loss against Florida, laying 4.5 points against North Carolina. You look at UNC, one of the more surprising results of opening weekend. They went from a 7-point dog to as much as a 12.5-point underdog, ended up erasing an 11-point deficit to upset South Carolina on a neutral in Charlotte. Folks around the UNC program saying this is going to be a massive game, a sellout expected, beer in the stadium. And when you look at Miami, they absolutely bludgeoned North Carolina a season ago, 47-10. Payne, how do we feel about the market knowing that this game opened with Miami a 6.5-point favorite? Full disclosure here, I had Miami circled on my sheet, but the market appears to disagree a little bit. Is this a sign of upgrading North Carolina's power profile based on a one-game sample size?
I'm certainly not taking North Carolina at 4.5. I'm just not doing it. But we've obviously seen signs of the Hurricanes still having issues offensively. There's a lot of question marks there. You would hope with 2 weeks to prepare and you have more time with the freshman quarterback to work on things, correct mistakes, that we would see this improved Hurricanes offense. And, you look at the level of competition as well. So they're getting the 2 weeks to prepare, 2 weeks to fix mistakes, and they're projected to go against a far easier defense in UNC than they faced against Florida. Now,
Jaren Williams isn't going to get sacked 10 times again this weekend?
We'll see. We know the freshman tackles struggled a lot. They saw some blitzes. It wasn't pretty. I just hope, and listen, I hate to be negative about Miami because people think it's me just, being a Florida State homer. It's not. If it was any other team, I'd talk about them the same way. I'm just not a Dan Enos guy. And he's already had multiple chances to be successful as a head coach. We know that. We outlined it at Central Michigan. He only won 41% of his games there. And in those five seasons at Central Michigan, his offenses weren't very good. Finished inside the top 80 in efficiency one time. And throughout the coaching community, most think he is wishy-washy at best. And that was proven again at Alabama when he left in the middle of the night like a coward without telling Nick Saban he was heading to Miami because he couldn't face him man-to-man. And so now after one game, Dan Enos is publicly calling out a true freshman quarterback to the media 20 minutes after the freaking game ended. So that's what makes me nervous about the Hurricanes offense. I just don't like the guy in charge. And I don't think he's very good at his job. So anyways, enough of that. This
God,
is
the only thing he didn't do there is insult his wife and children, Payne. Christ.
Oof. He probably wouldn't tell his wife if he was leaving her either. He just, you know. Anyways, this is...
Hey, well, Nick Saban is probably a lot scarier than his significant other. Assuming Dan is married, I won't claim to know exactly what his family life is like at home.
I don't know either, but I totally agree. But wouldn't that be someone that you'd like to have on your resume if you needed a job you're interviewing for to call and get a nice little recommendation from Nick Saban? Wouldn't that have been nice? You think you're getting that now?
One would think that would definitely help you open doors, but clearly, Dan wasn't thinking about it in broader strokes.
No. So, you know, when you look at this matchup, it's tough for me to gauge because, you know, I don't love Dan Enos, but coming into the season, I didn't think there was going to be much improvement for the North Carolina defense. You know, we had them projected to finish, you know, right around 90th in efficiency. I don't want to overreact to like a singular 60-minute sample size, but hats off to the co-defensive coordinators there, Jay Bateman, Tommy Thigpen. They were fantastic. They held Jake Bentley in check. The Gamecocks offense averaged 4.2 yards per play. UNC's defense created 10 negative plays, only allowed 2 of 20 or more yards. So, you know, I liked what I saw from their defense. I don't want to overreact because I don't expect it to be very good. I know they have. Like, they took their quarterback, moved him over to defense. He's like the leading tackler in game one. Like,
yeah,
you know, that's kind of the stuff
Stewart,
that teams...
he couldn't throw a forward pass, but he's out there playing middle linebacker trying to roll heads.
Yeah, so, I mean, it's a great story. But, you know, is that like the talent you're looking for at the ACC level? You know, I don't know. You know, I don't know. Kudos to him. But, you know, maybe with, you know, Jaron Williams, he gets a little help here. What I'm hearing a little bit out of Miami, because I have some sources there with 2 weeks of prep, there could be a little more Wildcat offense with DJ Dallas. He was a high school quarterback, so he's got that option within the Wildcat to throw it. Let's see if Enos has more packages for Tate Martell. He lined up at quarterback for 2 plays. He was in the slot for 5 plays. He was out wide lined up at receiver for 8 more. I would expect the execution. I would expect the creativity for Miami's offense to be a little bit better this week, Todd.
One thing I will say about North Carolina, it almost felt like a tale of two halves. Didn't pick up on it initially, had to do some reading. And when you look at Carolina, they ran 12 plays inside of the South Carolina 25-yard line in the first half. 11 of those plays, Payne, obviously by design, were runs. The only time they attempted a pass resulted in a sack, and I think that might be Mack Brown. Knowing he's got a true freshman, Sam Howell, and had to be a little more conservative. But in the second half, we see North Carolina go on drives of 95 and 98 yards against a South Carolina defense, who I don't think is great, but I think was going to provide a little bit of a stiff challenge. So when we look at those dynamics playing at home, do we think Mack Brown opens up the playbook a little bit more for Howell? A guy who was pretty highly regarded, and a slight surprise maybe that he won the quarterback race, but showed that North Carolina was committed to their future.
Man, that was good. That was impressive. And another loss, by the way, this week for Willie Taggart, because Sam Howell was a Florida State commit until like the 23rd and a half hour, and Mack Brown took him away. So not a good week for Willie Taggart. I'm intrigued to see this matchup. You know, Manny Diaz has a lot of motivation. All the motivation in the world. He's got 2 weeks to prepare.
Go
ahead.
No, I was going to let you get to that because that's one storyline that I don't think, obviously, a game that's not going to generate a ton of national interest. I want you to hit on the relationship or maybe the lack thereof between Manny Diaz and Mack Brown.
You know, it's an interesting one. I kind of want to preface it this way, and I know a lot of people will be like, oh my God, he got, you know, Mack Brown shit canned Manny Diaz because of like one game. I can tell you they were constantly butting heads when they were working together. Like, him and Mack Brown stylistically just didn't mesh, And I know Manny's come out this week. He said all the right things, right? It's like culture. It's more important than system. But listen, Manny isn't going to be Manny defensively. He's not changing his system for anybody. And he is going to be relentless. He's going to be aggressive. That's his system, right? He wants his defense to trigger quick. He wants him to play downhill. He wants him to cause negative plays. And if you look, when you're playing a true freshman quarterback in Sam Howell, the goal should be to make him uncomfortable. You know, force him to play in these long passing down situations. So we know how good Miami's defense was a season ago at creating these negative plays. Number one in tackles for loss. Number one in sack rate. Third in stuff rate. Against Florida, they only faced 53 offensive snaps, but, you know, Miami forced 8 negative plays or 0 yard gains. And they also had 5 takeaways in those 53 offensive snaps for Florida. So, you know, in knowing this, and I think you led us perfectly, I think Phil Longo, the UNC offensive coordinator, has to put Sam Howell in these good situations. I can't see a scenario where UNC runs the ball in 66% of snaps. You'd rather have a young quarterback throwing on an unpredictable situation first down than you would on a predictable situation second and long or third and long, right? Create some easy throws on early downs for Sam. If you look, and to kind of expound on what you said, if you look in the first half against South Carolina, Howell only passed the ball 8 times. UNC had 17 plays in the green zone in the first half. Howell was only allowed to throw it twice, and he wasn't allowed to throw it a single time in the red zone in the first half at all. And that's the reason, UNC was trailing at the break. We don't have to keep talking about this, but passing's more efficient than running it. And if you have a young, inexperienced quarterback, you want to give him easy throws, not third down and a mile throws. So when you look at that first half, you're trailing because your offense only averaged 4.8 yards per play in that first half. And then, you know, you have Mack and Longo, they go back in the second half and they open things up a little bit. And what do you know? Offense is more efficient, over 7 yards per play in the second half. I think UNC has to make Miami pay for their aggression, hit some explosive plays. If you look, again, they only passed the ball 34% of the snaps in that game against the Gamecocks, but they had 5 explosive plays. So that's a positive sign. For me, like, it'll be interesting to see what Miami's defense does a little bit. You know, there's been talks this week about getting more guys on the field. They only played 11 guys, played 84% of the snaps for Miami's defense. So it could be a situation where we see guys coming in and out of the lineup, trying to get more pressure. Manny Diaz has 2 weeks to prep for this game. And I think that'll be interesting. That's the dynamic here. He's already got the motivation. Now you got 2 weeks to prepare for a freshman quarterback. Going to be really interesting. You probably couldn't pay me here to be on North Carolina. And I get the story. It's going to be a great one. I'm happy for Mac, but it's just, it's not a game for me, especially at the current number.
Yeah, it feels like, one of those games that I think is going to tell us an awful lot about both these teams. And while sometimes early on in the season, you don't want to make blanket generalizations or try and take too much away from one data point or even two, this a handful of games that I think I'll be glued to my seat to try and figure out, hey, who North Carolina, who are they now and who are they going to be going forward with the coach? We had some questions about Mac returning, but we saw some of the success that Herm Edwards had returning to Arizona State. So I'm sure the faithful in Chapel Hill hoping for some of the same, which obviously can't be the case in a game taking place on the West Coast late at night where it's USC, a 1.5-point favorite against the Stanford Cardinal. We know about Clay Helton's job being very much on the hot seat, and things aren't going to get any easier when you lose your starting quarterback in JT Daniels for the season with an ACL meniscus tear. Of course, Jack Sears, who probably what is going to be the backup a lot of people thought had he wanted to stick around the program in the transfer portal. So it's now the baton handed off to Kadon Slovis. Meanwhile, on the Stanford side, Payne, we're not sure if it's going to be KJ Costello or Davis Mills taking reps there. An interesting game for all the wrong reasons.
Yeah, this, you know, we were trying to pick the, you know, 5 or 6 biggest games of the week. We're like, this was going to be a monster. Do we not discuss it at this point? Or what do we do? Do we throw in Syracuse, Maryland instead of this game? I don't have a ton on it, obviously, at this point. But David Shaw did come out at the early week presser and said this is not going to be a game day decision for Costello, and that, you know, Stanford will know at the latest by Friday morning. If Costello can't go, it's a massive blow. You mentioned the redshirt sophomore Davis Mills. He was a 5-star kid in the 2016 class. He was the number one pro-style quarterback. The unfortunate part is here is if it is, you know, Davis Mills, left tackle Walker Little is out as well. And if you rewind to the Pac-12 podcast, the two things that were certain about Stanford's offense coming into the season was Costello and a surefire NFL left tackle. It's going to be tough navigating without those two guys. Let's see what ends up playing out here. In the second half against Northwestern, a defense obviously that is going to project to be better than USC. We actually have them top 25. Stanford only averaged 4.6 yards per play with Davis Mills. And what was interesting to me is we've kind of bagged on David Shaw about not giving quarterbacks the chance to throw the ball downfield. But oddly, he allowed Davis Mills to do that a little bit. 13 of the first 22 offensive snaps, Mills passed the ball in the second half. So for me, it's an interesting test here. He obviously got his feet wet against a much better defense. Let's see if it transitions. I don't have a ton on this game at the current price. But just to me on paper, Mills has already been tested here against Northwestern defense. Came up a little bit short. This should be an easier task. He's now going to be implemented into the game plan, into the system. It's going to be catered to his likings, and I think that's probably a benefit.
The thing that's crazy about it, too, is you look at Mills, and the pedigree is clearly there for a quarterback that Stanford knew what they were getting. You mentioned how highly rated and regarded he was as a prospect from a pro-style standpoint. You would think the perfect fit to lead a Stanford offense, and maybe if the situation was different, he would have had a chance to win the starting job, if not backing up a guy like KJ Costello. When we look at the way this game played out last year, I mean, Stanford, the only team to hold USC below 14, the three-point output from the Trojans, the lowest output offensively from a USC football team since 1997. Payne, put yourself in the position of a David Shaw, and we'll get to USC in a second. With an inexperienced quarterback, down your left tackle, knowing the O-line was a concern, and you haven't shown much of a explosive ground game, because Cameron Scarlett, in my opinion, is more of a plotter that's going to get you 4 to 4.5 yards. He's not going to have that Bryce Love explosive big play potential. Is it a game where you try and run the football, or you take some of those short, easy, intermediate throws, and you're okay with punts, going, hey, we're going to turn it into a field position contest, knowing that we don't want it to be a track meet?
You would think so, right? And you revert back to your personality. And maybe this is where we see David Shaw continuing to ground and pound. Again, in that second half, I was surprised because you had the double-digit lead. And you came out and you let Davis chuck the ball around, at least initially, until the final two possessions on offense where you're like, let's hold on to dear life here with this three-point lead. I know if you listen to Shaw after in the post-game presser, he was talking about being the bigger man up front. He was talking about, you know, he was praising Cameron Scarlett, said how much he's worked this offseason in the weight room, getting quicker, getting stronger. It tells me that there's going to be a lot of Cameron Scarlett in this game. So it's really interesting. Now, the total is tricky because if you have information, obviously, on KJ Costello, it'd probably be best to go under now if it is Davis. But God forbid he gets upgraded, you're going to be sitting on the wrong end of a ticket. So that's what makes this game so difficult for me. I'm still poking around on the Costello information.
Yeah, and I think what's interesting about it, and we talked about the consensus number here. You do have one shop in the desert that actually has Stanford a 1-point favorite. The game of the year line during the summer, all things being equal, would have had USC about a 5-point favorite. So you're seeing the market respond. When I look at my numbers, KJ Costello, one of the more valuable quarterbacks in all of college football in terms of what the downgrade would be to the backup. I don't feel quite the same way about JT Daniels. I know he had the potential and big things were expected in a Graham Harrell offense, but I don't think USC has to change its identity nearly as much. One thing I will say from watching that entire second half, and I think it was probably past your bedtime, against Fresno State, he throws for 57 yards, great on the surface, but 41 of those 57 yards comes on one big pass play. And having watched that game with not a vested financial interest, but knowing that my life was going to get more difficult at home if USC lost outright as a 14-point favorite, if they don't hit the big kick return from Velus Jones to change the dynamic, when the air had been taken out of the stadium, I think it's a much different dynamic now, and Clay Helton's job gets that much more difficult. We'll see if they run the ball, but I can definitely see why a case can be made for going under the total, especially if KJ Costello is out of the fold. One last thing on this game, Payne. I know we have one more Pac-12 game to get to. What was the expectation for you guys on USC coming into the season? The general buzz is where they projected from an efficiency standpoint.
So when we talked about them in the Pac-12 podcast, it was a team that we thought was going to be improved, but the schedule was an absolute bear, and the schedule was rough at the beginning stages. And so that's where our reservations came from, because if they didn't start hot, then you could be playing with a lame duck coach and you wouldn't get to the back half of the schedule that was conducive to some victories. And I can tell you, just looking at this number, it was a little, we had it a little bit shorter because, again, we did project USC to be improved. We made it 3.5 if everyone was healthy in this game. And so, you know, you mentioned Slovis a little bit. Again, had an entire half to get his feet wet against Fresno. Fresno's a better defense, I think, based on our projections than what you'll see here with Stanford. I was looking at this in the second half, just 5.1 yards per play. And as you alluded to, 1/3 of those yards came on that 41-yard explosiveness. For me, Trojans' offensive line has to step up in a big way this week. It was a question mark coming into the season. It was a unit that wasn't great last year, 100th in adjusted line yards, 86th in stuff rate. They weren't great in protection either, but I think there were signs of improvement in week one against Fresno. And again, you know, we don't want to overreact to 60 minutes of football, but to me, USC only allowed one sack last year. Carr and Vave, or whatever his name is, they combined for 6.6 yards per rush attempt. So I think when you look at Graham Harrell's system, that style is going to help a little bit here, right? It's about the short passing game. Get it out quick. It'll help the O-line with protection. You know, you get Slovis comfortable. You get him confident if he can hit a few quick short ones. Again, there's just a ton of uncertainty here for me. And it comes down to, you know, we're going to be poking around here in the next 24 hours on some Costello information.
No doubt about it. One thing I will say for those folks who don't know what they're going to hear shared on the telecast. Slovis is product of Scottsdale, Arizona. He was coached by Kurt Warner, so you're going to hear that about 97 times in the telecast, so we wanted to preface it accordingly. So he has...
Three-star guy, right?
And you know what? Hey, look, you give the kid credit for sticking out in the program. I imagine somewhere Jack Sears is out there listening to the podcast going, hey, that could have been my job if I didn't want to go into the transfer portal, but it'll save me a rant on college quarterbacks deciding that, hey, they'd rather take the path of least resistance as soon as things get difficult. All right, to the final game, speaking of a path of least resistance and getting less difficult, to a starting quarterback in Washington who acquitted himself quite well in his homecoming of sorts, Jacob Eason. It'll be the Washington Huskies, a 2-touchdown favorite against California. Total on this game, 45. Revenge pain clearly has to be on the mind of the Huskies and Chris Peterson after they lost 12-10 a season ago, despite not allowing an offensive touchdown. The last time these two teams played in Seattle, Washington took care of business by the tune of 38-7. And I mentioned Eason, outstanding in his debut, 27 of 36, 349 yards, 4 touchdowns versus Eastern Washington. I know a lot of people are going to say, hey, look, it's an FCS opponent. But yes, it's an FCS opponent that had a chance to play for a national championship last year. And this was a Washington team that only converted 57% of their red zone trips into touchdowns a season ago, 105th nationally. When we look at the Huskies, I know this was a polarizing team. We talked about them in great detail on our preview podcast for the Pac-12. What are your expectations for them maybe as a whole, or more so, I guess, as it pertains to the game against Cal as 2-touchdown favorites?
You know, listen, you'd obviously rather have Jacob Eason play the best game of his life, or, you know, rather than struggle against an FCS defense in Eastern Washington.
San Diego State.
But again, yeah, that was rough. I can't figure out that game. Some sharp money hit UCLA, but interesting. I think UCLA, not to go off on a tangent, has some O-line issues this week, so it'll be interesting.
Well, hopefully they have their starting running back. San Diego State's defensive running line back as well.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see. You know, I don't really want to overreact to what Eason did in his career performance. But again, you know, you great showing. He had a 729-day layoff. But this is going to sound weird, I think, to people. All of the sharpest guys that I speak to and associate with, we actually downgraded Washington off that performance. So, you know, not what Washington fans want to hear. I absolutely love Chris Peterson. He's going to get the most out of his guys. But this week is the real test because Cal's defense, I think, provides us the barometer. It's going to provide some information and helping us figure out what Washington's offense can be. Cal's defense is one that we project to finish top 10 in defensive efficiency. I know UC Davis is going to have this electric offense at the FCF level. So I think holding them to 3.2 yards per play was actually impressive. I know a few leaders on the defense didn't like their performance, but I thought they were actually pretty good against UC Davis. But from what I'm seeing, like the question marks that a lot of people had at Washington was Eason's ability to sense pressure, his pocket presence. He's got a great offensive line. There's going to be a couple pros on that side of the ball. if Cal can get pressure, it's going to go a long way to winning this game. You mentioned the revenge. For me, the number's perfect. Made it 12.5. So there's not a lot of room to invest for me here. This, to me, is just a huge test because I think we know Washington's defense is going to take a little bit of a step back. It's got to be about Eason and the offense really projecting forward and improving, specifically with the explosive plays. We know that was an issue with Jake Browning last year. The accuracy was good, didn't have the big play potential. We know Eason has the arm. So, again, it's about Washington's offense really improving, and this will be the litmus test here against Cal's defense.
Poor Jake Browning. Did he latch on to another NFL roster? I know he was cut by the Vikings when they went paired the roster down from 90 down to 53, but I didn't see if he latched on anywhere else.
I don't know. Let's see.
Around there.
Says he still – says I think they may have re-signed him to the practice
squad. I got you. That would make some sense then. I know he was a roster cut casualty. It'd be interesting to see what happens there. But you mentioned that Cal defense, and ironically enough, found a quote from their defensive leader, Evan Weaver, who basically said, as a defense, we played horrible. We're not ready. But we'll be ready next Saturday. You can believe that. Right now, it's not looking good, but we'll get it right. Then we'll fly up there and we'll beat them. That's what we do. We win games. We figure it out. So clearly, Cal's performance against UC Davis wasn't up to their high standards. And I think when you look at this Cal team, the biggest question mark we had coming into the season wasn't going to be anything they could do defensively, because when they were out there and they were able to have rest, this was going to be a relatively elite unit. The problem for the Cal defense was how many snaps they'd have to be out there, what kind of precarious position the offense would put them in. And when you look at the way Cal played offensively last week against UC Davis, it wasn't exactly a ringing endorsement for anything. And I, Payne, have not been a fan of Chase Garbers when he was on the roster and he got limited reps last year. I'm definitely not going to be a fan of him in hostile territory here, but 14, a big number, especially with a total that's actually been bet up a little bit today, but still under a key number at 45.
Yeah. I'm trying to give him some credit. So for
look
me,
at you,
it's
the glass half full guy.
Always. You look, and obviously Cal didn't exceed their market expectation. But again, UC Davis is a top five FCS opponent. They're led by their offense. So to me, I was somewhat impressed, I guess. Anytime you lose the turnover battle by three or more and not only manage to win, but come away with a double digit victory, I'm okay with that. And that's what Cal did. It wasn't this stiff UC Davis defense that Cal went against, but you look at Chase Garbers. I know the completion percentage isn't great. 57% in that opener doesn't seem to show improvement there, but there were some signs. They hit some downfield plays, averaged 8.3 yards per pass attempt adjusted for opponent. The Cal offense showed some pop. It was something we haven't seen from them last year, right? They finished 126 in explosiveness. So again, you know, UC Davis or not, having 9 plays of 10 or more, 5 plays of 20 or more, 3 plays of 30 or more, that's the kind of explosiveness we didn't see from Cal a season ago against anybody. So this is obviously a different test going up against Washington, but I think their defense is a unit that we project to regress a little bit. Right now, we're projecting them to finish just inside the top 25 in defensive efficiency. They have shown an ability over the years not to give up the explosive play. They make you work for everything. So Garbers is going to need to be more efficient down to down. He's going to need to be more successful. He's going to need to be more efficient, complete more passes, because Washington's going to give you the underneath stuff. They just don't want to get beat deep. That's the whole premise of 5 members in the secondary. So that'll be the test for Garbers. Can he be efficient passing the ball? 5 yards here, 6 yards there, just complete the passes, stay ahead of the downs. And if they can do that, you can methodically move the football.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a sucker for bad offenses and good defenses, so this will be a game that I'm glued to the edge of my seat. I think you actually have some intriguing games in that 10:30 Eastern time slot. But Payne, before we get into closing up shop and talking about our best bet, I did want to get your take. Week 2 for me, like I mentioned earlier, is so fascinating because you have a number of games that kind of give us an indication of where these teams will be. And when I go through the schedule, I mean, 5 games that kind of jump off to me. Syracuse, Maryland, given the line move, I think is going to be a very interesting watch as we try and figure out exactly what those two teams are. You have a game between Nebraska and Colorado, which is a massive adjustment from where the game of the year number would have been, with Nebraska 9-point favorite and still seeing some money come in from professionals on Colorado. Revenge type scenario there. We look at some of the other games later in the day, Minnesota, Fresno State, those type of contests. Is there a game, maybe BYU, Tennessee, is there a game that you want to see? you know, just to kind of get a gauge of where these teams are more than anybody, more than the big five that we discussed?
Yeah, I mean, I'm really intrigued to see if Maryland can follow up that performance. I'm not high on Syracuse this year. Obviously, love Dino Babers. Quarterback situation looks a little bleak. I figured the removal of Dungy kind of moving on. He was just such a big part to that offense, contributed so much on the ground, both in percentage of yards gained, but touchdowns rushing as well. So life without Dungy wasn't great. This is a big spot for Maryland, but we've seen them come out hot before in the beginning of the season. So I'm intrigued to see where this line goes now. We've obviously come across the zero. If it gets to three, I think we're going to see some resistance. So I don't know if this is now the number you want to be jumping in at Maryland minus 2.5. It's not for me. I'm intrigued to see Nebraska. They were very fortunate to even win last week. Three special teams and defensive touchdowns. They only win by 14. From what I've been hearing, it's not going to be a pleasant week at practice. I'm not a huge fan of Colorado. CSU might be one of the worst coach teams in the entire college football nation, and they outplayed Colorado a little bit. So you mentioned that massive adjustment. I am not running to take the four with Colorado. In fact, if you know I had a gun to my head and I could lay three, I'd probably look that way with Nebraska. So a lot of interesting games, some that we didn't cover. Where do we want to go? Do we want to go with the best bet?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's that time of the show where we should try and figure out where we're going to go from investment. I know we took some heat last week for Michigan. People go, oh, you guys, we don't need your podcast to try and tell us to lay three touchdowns. Hey, guys, we gave it out at 20.5. Game closed 23.5. It's 24-7. We should be getting the ball back. If it wasn't for a fumbled punt, we cashed that ticket. But you know what? We didn't. We own the...
I like that you addressed that. Usually I don't, just because...
Yeah, I want to get it out there.
You're gonna lose 45% of the time, but you also... You undersold us there. Pinnacle closed 24 minus 10 on the first
half. So close even further. But it's one of those things. I know we have a lot of... You know, our old listeners are back. They know how we conduct our business. There's some new listeners. And we're not here to sugarcoat it. Hey, when we win, we'll tell you we win. When we lose... We'll lose. If it's a bad bet, we'll tell you. Don't fail. That was a bad bet. Just didn't get us to the window there. All right.
The edge there if we want to go one step further. And again, I don't defend any of our like, I'm not here. Game's over. We're moving on. But if you did your reading, they were so happy getting Josh Gattis' new offense in there. They were talking about, if they won the toss, receiving. And MTSU is known to defer. So we were effectively getting the ball to start the game no matter what. And that was part of our built-in edge. Unfortunately, there was a fumble on the
very first offensive snap. Nice job, Shea Patterson. Hold on to the damn football, which actually was a theme for the weekend for some of the quarterbacks we backed.
Oof. Yeah. Nasty, nasty negative fumble luck this weekend. But I feel good knowing that we had that fumble luck, negative fumble luck, and we still survived opening weekend. It was ugly for a lot of...
Wasn't exactly the best. That is for sure. But all right, no excuses around here. This is a bottom line business. So when we look at the card this weekend, I know we had quite a bit of back and forth trying to figure out what direction we wanted to go. And since you ultimately get the deciding vote, I'm as curious to know as our listeners are where we're putting our shekels into play.
Oh, massive game, huge game. Let's go with Coastal Carolina. 363, Coastal Carolina plus 8. The goal is to get anything better than a touchdown. So 7.5 or better, but 8 is the widely available number. I know there's a few shops out there, I guess, at least before we started talking, that had some 9.5, if that's an option. If you can find an affordable 10 buy, that may be worth it. But for me, Coastal Carolina outplayed EMU big time last weekend. And I know they're transitioning their practice schedule a little bit this week due to Hurricane Dorian. I think it's going to have a rallying effect. Seems to be the case. We saw it with Boise. I'm not buying Kansas. They were outplayed last week by an FCS team. It required a pick six
the
touchdown.
Fighting Larry they Burns, get, how dare you sell the Sycamore short?
Yeah. And for me, I didn't like what I saw from Kansas. This wasn't a team that, Les Miles coming in and he was going to bring them hype and change the culture. Like, No one was buying it that was on the professional side. Everyone was going under on Kansas's win total. So I'm not buying it. They do get Puka Williams back, which is a huge get back for that offense. But I think Coastal Carolina does enough to keep this within a touchdown.
And one thing, too, because I know we don't talk about it great lengths, and we're always reluctant, or at least I am, for us to divulge any of our specifics ingredients that go into it. From a Power 5 conference standpoint, I have Kansas as one of the worst home field advantages. And typically when they play conference foes that have been in there, I won't even adjust at all for home field. For this game, Payne, I made a half a point adjustment in Kansas's favor. Despite it being Les Miles' second game and all the optimism there that Kansas could move to 2-0 in the young season.
Very smart. So, let's just put it this way that, again, these are power numbers. Anything can happen over a 60-minute sample, but I know we talked off air about this. The team Coastal Carolina just outplayed. We'd probably make a favorite on a neutral over Kansas.
That we indeed would. So we're going big game hunting, ladies and gentlemen. Big game hunting with the Coastal Carolina Chanticleers. So if you don't know what a Chanticleer is, it's a perfect time to go research it and figure out exactly what it means. But take the 8, widely available, 7.5, still an acceptable number. I think that just about does it, Payne. We're real close to that hour threshold. You said you wanted to get in and out in 37 minutes today. We weren't able to accommodate that particular request. Again, the Bet the Board football 5K free roll. We'll talk about it on the NFL podcast tomorrow. But go to the Bet the Board Twitter, at Bet the Board Pod. There's a tweet posted there. I know Payne's tweeted out a bunch. I have as well. Make sure you're following all three of us. You retweet that. Get in, sign up, absolutely free to play. $5,000 prize pack available to you. But be ready to bring the A game. Might take you about 70% win clip to put that trophy on your mantle. Any final words of wisdom, parting shots that you would like to share as it pertains to the college football schedule week 2?
No, that is everything. Again, the contest, just go to bettheboardcontest.com, sign up. Tomorrow is our NFL Week 1 podcast, so get in your 5-star reviews on iTunes, leave a nice little sentence. We'll have a drawing after the podcast. If you've left a 5-star review and a nice little sentence, you're automatically entered into the contest, so we will announce the winner of that tomorrow morning on the podcast. So you got about 24 hours, less than that, to get in those 5-star iTunes reviews. And again, it'll be a nice little Bet the Board swag pack with a Visa gift card and some t-shirts and whatnot. So 5-star review on iTunes, you're automatically entered. And sign up for the contest, bettheboardcontest.com.
Coastal Carolina, 7 o'clock Eastern time, wherever you choose to watch the games, your man cave, your local watering hole at your friend's place. Make sure they put that on the big screen front and center. No guarantees in terms of the announcers will sound any better than they would for a high school game. But the money will pay. Just the same. Coastal Carolina plus 7.5. Good luck with all of your bets this weekend. Enjoy the big games, and we'll see you at the window.